from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the early hours of August 6, 1945, when an aircraft recently christened as the Enola Gay departed for Hiroshima, Japan, with Paul Tibbetts at the controls. At about 2:30 that morning, Tibbetts had smiled for photographs before taking off on the mission. On board was an atomic bomb, codenamed Little Boy. Tibbetts and the crew found Hiroshima under clear skies and dropped the bomb at 8:15 a.m. local time. They had less than a minute to fly away before it detonated about 2,000 feet over the city. By the standards of the U.S. military, that mission was a success. The bomb destroyed its target, 80,000 people dying, many of them nearly instantly, tens of thousands of more sick and dying in the following days, weeks, and months. We've now marked 70 years since the bombing of Hiroshima, the first nuclear weapon deployed during war. 3 days later, a different crew dropped a plutonium bomb on the city of Nagasaki. The purpose was to win the war, quickly and decisively, without a ground invasion. World War II had seen nearly 60 million deaths. This week, as we mark the occasion, we're asking how the bombings are taught and considered in various classroom settings. Philosophy, ethics, history, and culture. Paul Tibbetts endured criticism throughout his life. Yes, he was also celebrated as a hero. Before he died, Tibbetts regularly pushed back against the criticism. He said in 2005, quote, "I'm proud. I sleep clearly every night. I knew when I got the assignment it was going to be an emotional thing. We had feelings, but we had to put them in the background. We knew it was going to kill people right and left, but my one driving interest was to do the best job I could so that we could end the killing as quickly as possible," end quote. Hisatuni Sakumizu, who's the Japanese chief cabinet secretary during World War II, called that bomb a gift from heaven, a chance to finally end the war. Is that right? Well, let's talk about it this hour. My guests for the hour are Richard Dees, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Rochester. It's great to have you here again, Richard. Thanks for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
Also here is Professor Joanne Bernardi, whose research and teaching focus on Japanese cinema and culture. Tell us a little bit about the class you you've taught as well, Joanne.
Yes, For the past 10 years, I've been teaching a course called Atomic Creatures Godzilla. And it focuses basically on the different reactions in the United States, the history of the attitudes toward nuclear weapons in the United States and Japan.
And on the line with us is Eric Wheeler. He's an adjunct history professor at MCC. He's taught World War II classes. And nice to have you, Eric. Thanks for taking the time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on today, Adam.
Let me just start, and Eric, I'll start with you, and we'll go around the panel on this. I have seen many, many conversations, debates, written articles in the last week marking 70 years since the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and so often I see it reduced to a question, which is, well, what would a ground invasion have cost? The estimates given to the president at the time, 250,000 to 1 million dead. And that this was sort of a cost-benefit analysis, that do you want 1 million dead potentially in a ground invasion that's protracted, or can you end the war with a bomb or two? And that is often the equation that people use to look at this. Is that the right way to look at this?
I think you have, a number of various motivations contributing to President Truman's decision. Certainly, as you mentioned, there's military considerations, but the bomb, in many people's estimation, was not a necessity for winning the war. The Japanese military was on their heels at that point. But in other motivations, this weapon had a clear long-term diplomatic implication and really sets the stage for U.S. atomic diplomacy. There was a psychological power to this weapon. Another thing you need to consider, too, is the very momentum of the Manhattan Project itself. Millions of dollars spent, 100,000+ employees. Yes, there were going to be considerable casualties if we went ashore in Japan, and certainly the memory of the Battle of Okinawa from April to June 45 was very fresh in everybody's mind, 13,000+ killed in action. But this is something that there were a number of different motivations contributing to this, and that's something that we talk with students about, about this decision that was made 70 years ago that really changed the course of human history.
Professor Bernardi, how do you view the lens of how we discuss the ethics of what happened?
Well, one thing I noticed when I read the coverage in the New York Times recently was, I guess I was profoundly saddened by the fact that we're still asking the question, should we have dropped the bomb? One of the things I always start my class with is to ask the students if they know how many nuclear detonations there have been over time. And they usually start out with, you know, a handful. And occasionally they'll get the number right. 2,059, I think, is the estimate. And then we go on to the fact that the United States has detonated over 1,000 of those. And I guess I'm always struck by the very kind of short-sightedness of that question, you know, should we have dropped the bomb? Because it implies that somehow the effect of the bomb is limited to the fact that it did possibly stop the war sooner than it would have stopped beforehand. I always wonder about whether or not people are aware of the precedents that it set for warfare that would come after that, setting a pattern for a kind of warfare that was unprecedented.
Perhaps, and before I bring in Richard Deason, let me just follow up that question with the comment that I've heard often from our listeners on social media this morning, which is that not only did it effectively end the war quickly, but we haven't seen a nuclear weapon deployed on a civilian population in the 70 years since. And so it had not apparently set some kind of a precedent. Now, I'm not arguing for or against that position. I hear it espoused often. What do you make of it?
We have not seen a weapon deployed on a civilian population in the context of war. We have seen a lot of nuclear weapons deployed. The testing, for example, that the United States did in the Pacific resulted in the vaporization of the vaporization of four islands and the exodus of a whole people from their lifestyle and the way of life that they had. So I guess it's just striking to me that even after the effects of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the continuation of a very escalated, very aggressive form of nuclear, nuclear experimentation continued the way it did.
Okay.
I mean, that's hindsight, but.
Richard?
Well, there's two really fundamental different ways of looking at this issue. One is to use the perspective that you're using, a kind of cost-benefit analysis. Now, you can use that kind of cost-benefit analysis, but you do have to think about, if you're going to do that, you're going to have to think about all the costs and all the consequences in the long run. So what Joanne was saying there is very relevant. It's like you have to think about what's the precedent. Now, actually, I think the precedent is actually a little muddled here, because if we hadn't used the bomb in Hiroshima, would we have been more likely to use it in someplace like Korea or something like that? Because we didn't know what it would do. We didn't know how bad it would be. So the consequence of there is a little bit sticky. You also have to think about, did you need to do this in order to end the war quickly? And there's actually a pretty good case to be made that the war was going to end quickly, period. The Russians were invading Manchuria. They invaded on the 8th of August. They were overrunning the Japanese army in China. And so there was good evidence to think that the war was going to end quickly anyway. So if that's your calculation, did you need to do this? Okay, so that's one perspective on this is, from a purely looking at the consequences, you have to think about the consequences both in the short run and the long run. The best case you can make for it is we had to do this in order to end the war quickly to prevent a ground invasion. And that's a factual question, or kind of a quasi-counterfactual question. That's actually not that easy to determine, but that's the best case you can make for it. The other way of looking at this is to think about some very basic moral principles. A very basic moral principle in warfare is that we don't target civilians. So you don't set out to kill innocent civilians. Okay, so on this principle, you're allowed to bomb things. You're allowed to bomb military targets, and you can accept certain amount of civilian casualties. That has to be sort of proportionate to the goals that you're actually achieving. This is known as the principle of the doctrine of double effect. So the idea is that you can target something for a good effect. You have to measure the bad effects. You can't be intending the bad effects. You have to minimize the bad effects, but you can accept some. So on that standard, the bombing of Hiroshima doesn't work, right? The There were very little military targets in Hiroshima. There was a reason why it hadn't been bombed before, and it's because it wasn't an important military target or would have been bombed before. So it was completely disproportionate to the amount of civilians that were killed and that you knew were going to be killed. And the point was to kill those civilians. So there's an argument to be made that this kind of an act is, so I'll put it tendentiously, is a terrorist act. It's a terrorist act in the sense of it was aimed at a civilian population with the goal of terrorizing that civilian population for political goals, in other words, to get Japanese out of the war. Right. So that's the most tendentious way to put it. Right. So on those principles, it just doesn't fly. Now, of course, lots of other things that happened in World War II don't fly for the same reason. The firebombing of Tokyo is unjustified for the same reason. The firebombing of Dresden is unjustified for the same reasons. But on that kind of a moral perspective, you can't justify this at all.
Okay. But now let me also...
I've given you two perspectives, and there's one in which you can try to justify it, even though it's a little tricky.
Well, and I want to make sure I'm understanding whether you're sort of offering us the classroom perspective on two frames of looking at it, or do you subscribe to one frame or the other?
Well, I have to say, personally, I kind of go a little bit back and forth. So sometimes I see the point of, especially from the point of view of 1945, the professor was talking about, you know, given the perspective of Okinawa, where there were, you know, over 200,000 people died at Okinawa between civilian and military casualties, it's hard to look at an invasion of Japan and think this is not going to be a human disaster of even greater proportions in many ways than the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were. So from that perspective, I can see why that feels like a compelling argument. So when I'm thinking about it from that perspective, I go, oh yeah, sure. And then when I'm thinking about it from this classic just war perspective, I think there's no way you justify it. So I have to say, I have somewhat mixed feelings about it.
Yeah, I understand that. And then there are the questions that I think have been asked throughout the last 70 years, and I don't know that I have a good answer for them. So let me start by asking Professor Wheeler, and I'll ask our panel this. As we look at the droppings of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, could there have been a warning to a civilian population? Could you have demonstrated the power of the bomb without doing it on a civilian center? And could you have waited another 3 to 5 days before hitting Nagasaki just to find out if the effects of Hiroshima would have enacted the capitulation that you wanted? Professor Wheeler, how would you address those?
You know, in July of 45, you know, the Potsdam Declaration, you know, we said, you know, unconditional surrender, and then there was the threat of this, you know, prompt and utter destruction, although no one knew exactly, you know, what that meant at that time. And as was just mentioned, if you back up just a few months before that, March of 45, the firebombing of Tokyo, where more than 100,000 civilians were killed with incendiary munitions, cluster, white phosphorus, and things of that nature, that you look at moving forward now, and this line between military and civilian casualties starts to become blurred. Air Force bombings in Dresden and Tokyo showed that aerial destruction was, you know, something that land armies were unable to do. And this was just something that certainly was on the minds of our policymakers. What the not only military implications of this war, but also the political and diplomatic implications of using this weapon and how that would set us up in a post-war world, because it was very clear at this point the war was drawing to a close.
Well, let me read a comment then that came from Akihiro Takahashi, who is a survivor of Hiroshima. He was 14 years old when the bomb hit, lost skin on his arms and most of the skin on his hands in the bombing. He became director of the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Museum, and he spoke to Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times about the ethics of the bomb. Here is his quote. Quote, I'd like to ask why the U.S. dropped two different types of bombs, uranium type and plutonium type, on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Why make two kinds? That was an American strategy to keep superiority over the Soviet Union after the war, because Americans knew that Japan would surrender soon anyway, so they wanted to experiment to see which type of bomb would be more effective. I think that's evident in that Truman told Churchill about the bomb, but not Stalin. It was an experiment to see which bomb Americans should rely on. uranium or plutonium. Therefore, there was no need to drop the bomb on cities because it was an experiment. I think the argument that the bomb was necessary to save lives came afterward, and the real reason was the American nuclear strategy against the Soviet Union going forward. Professor Wheeler, what do you make of that comment?
Well, there's certainly in those motivations that Truman and others are looking at is this intent to perhaps gain leverage in future negotiations with the Soviets. But you can argue that perhaps this had the opposite effect. You know, within a few years, by September of 1949, the Soviets had a viable atomic weapon themselves. So, you know, looking at this in all the different motivations that led to this decision, I don't think they were purely military. I don't think they were purely diplomatic. I think they were a combination of a number of different factors in a total war that the world was fighting, you know, at that point.
We've been hearing from a number of you on Twitter as well, and many of the comments indicate that a tragic decision, but a lot of our listeners are telling us, supported by just the comparison of what a ground invasion would have cost. Tom says, ended the war and probably saved lives overall. There's no moral conflict for me. Boy, to have no moral conflict, that's a very strong... But he's saying that he thinks it was clearly justified. Brad says, my grandfather was in one of two divisions that fought in Europe and was slated to invade Japan. It was a terrible thing, but it ultimately probably saved lives. Conventional bombing and invasion would also have had countless civilian casualties. And on, many comments just like that. Stephen, I lean toward the idea that it saved lives. My grandfather was just old enough to be almost through training and would have been deployed to invasion. Hitting a military target would have been preferable, but weighing civilian casualties versus the invasion cost in lives on both sides is hard. And Tim sends us a more forceful comment. He says, are you kidding? Tell my grandfathers that they were part of a terrorist act. I don't think Richard is saying that it was definably, definitely a terrorist act, but you're saying that if you actually look at the framework of how we define terrorism.
If you look at the framework of how we define terrorism, it looks like it fits. I mean, here's the question. If your justification for it is it ends the war quickly, it saves lives in the long run, that's a justification that can be used on many different kinds of grounds, right? And so it justifies many different kinds of actions, most of which we usually regard with horror. Now, I think it's hard in this case. And I think one of the things that makes it hard, for Americans especially, is that what it unquestionably saved was lots of American lives. It saved lots of American lives. Because that whatever was going to happen with that invasion, it was going to cost tens of thousands, at least, of American lives. And so the people who are talking about, look, my grandfather was saved by this bomb, they may be right. There's a pretty good case that they are right.
Okay.
Whatever kind of invasion was going to take place, it was going to be one that was going to cost a lot of American casualties.
And Professor Bernardi, what would you say to that notion of the way Americans viewed the bomb? I mean, I think of Paul Tibbetts, who was immediately given an honor that morning. They finished their bombing run that afternoon. He comes back and he's celebrated. He was viewed very quickly as a hero. And I'm not saying I don't understand why that is, but some have said over the years that they felt like it was easier for the United States to decide to drop a bomb mm-hmm. on Japan than Germany, for example. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that?
I think there's a lot of support for that. If you look at anti-war propaganda, a lot of times Germany is portrayed by Adolf Hitler, a caricature of Adolf Hitler. Japan is usually portrayed by a caricaturized Asian person, buck teeth, glasses, just, you know, and anybody. So it's a very abstract sense of someone who is Asian, not one particular person. So you have a whole abstraction of the Japanese race in this kind of cartoon character. So I think that probably there was the perception of the Japanese as being, well, very sneaky. They had bombed Pearl Harbor. That certainly, I think, exacerbated people's reactions toward the Japanese. I think that I agree with what Professor Deese said about the fact that it saved American lives. I think we're the only ones who ever asked that question. You know, should we have dropped the bomb? I think if you look at it in a broader perspective, it's an act of dropping a bomb on the planet. And we didn't really have a conception of the whole Earth, a visual of Earth without national boundaries until really the 1970s. And so the whole bombing of Hiroshima does get confined to that kind of myopic, you know, us versus them paradigm. I think, you know, I'm really struck by Howard Zinn wrote a book called The Bomb, and he writes in that book how he was actually in the Army. He was in the Air Force. He dropped bombs, and he talks about his immediate reaction to hearing that the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima and saying, I was happy. I was really glad because this meant that the war was going to end and I wouldn't have to be deployed to the Pacific. So I think it's only natural that there was that reaction at the time. You know, it was in the context of, as has been described already, total war.
Alan writes to the program and says, please keep in mind these people were evil. There was no surrender coming, and this was the most unfortunate but best way out of the war. He says these people were evil and that there was no surrender coming. Professor Wheeler, just briefly on the question of surrender, Alan is saying they were holding out to the bitter end and this was the way to tell them it was over.
I think one thing we need to realize, you know, you have the Manhattan Project, and that's initiated in direct response to German advances in their own nuclear capabilities. And I think within the Roosevelt administration, he and his chief aides and military leaders viewed this as being a legitimate weapon against both the Germans and against the Japanese. By the time these were viable weapons, the Germans were already out of the war. So I think that's important to realize up front as well. But to those comments that this was our way to end the war, yes, has been discussed already in this program. Is this a way to expedite Japanese surrender? Yes. And for those service members who were fighting in 1945, was this yet another tool in that arsenal in a total war to effect that unconditional surrender that the president wanted? Yes, it was.
Before I get to the phones, and we're going to take your phone calls this hour as we talk about the ethics of the bomb 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. My great fear for the world going forward is to see a nuclear device take out a major world population center, because my fear is if that happens, that will precipitate the use of these weapons on population centers at a scale that will be really, really horrifying. I think about my own son's lifetime. I just pray it doesn't happen going forward. And my question is the use of a nuclear device, even for the idea of ending a war, is that likely to precipitate more? Now, you can argue in 70 years we haven't seen it, at least in that context. And of course, Joanne's been telling us we have seen the use of nuclear devices, maybe not in the same way we saw in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But I think of, you know, the idea that, well, we wanted to end the war. We could have used a nuclear device to end the war in Vietnam or in Afghanistan, Iraq. There's a lot of places that you could decide that you want to create a dramatic result. And we haven't done it. And in many ways, I'm heartened to see that we haven't done it. But is the use of a device likely to precipitate more use of a device? Richard, I don't know if anybody knows the answer to that, but it feels like inevitably it kind of is. I don't know.
Yeah, I actually think that question is actually really hard to parse, because I think there is a reasonable case to be made that if we had not used the nuclear weapons in to end the war with Japan, then we would have been more likely to use them in later conflicts. I think there's a reasonable case to be made for that. So I'm not sure that question has quite the result that you think it does.
Okay.
That we've broken a precedent here, and because we've broken that precedent, it makes it less. Makes
no,
it more likely that we're going to use it.
You're giving me hope. This is exactly what I'm hoping to hear, because it has been 70 years. And you're saying that precisely the reason we haven't used it in future conflicts was we saw what happened.
We saw what happened. We saw the horror of what this kind of weapon does to people.
Okay.
And I hope that's enough in most cases, unfortunately think it's probably not.
Professor Bernardi?
I agree. I do believe that if it hadn't been used then, it would have been used by someone at some point. There's a very interesting film that came out. I mean, I think we have to look, too, at the scientist's perspective on this. And the American Federation of Scientists came out with a film in 1946. So it was really very, very close to the bombing, called One World or None. And they made the case very forcefully that, any use of an atomic bomb really meant the end for everybody, not just for whatever population happened to be the recipient of that one particular bomb.
Mm. Professor Wheeler?
I think another good documentary that if people are interested in this, and one that we show students when teaching about this, is HBO Films did a documentary called White Light, Black Rain. And they interviewed the surviving members of the air crew, the Enola Gay, some of the other aircraft that were in that formation on the Grand Artiste, some of the scientists and whatnot. And although Colonel Tibbetts had died before the documentary was made, the bombardier was still alive. And they asked him, the question that everyone asks, do you regret your decision for doing this? And he says in the documentary, "I don't regret that decision one bit. What I regret, though, is that I'll be out in a crowd and someone will be talking about, the war in Iraq, and they'll say, why don't we just drop a nuke on them?" He says to this point, idiot doesn't even know what a nuke is. Right? And his thought is, how have we not learned more? And this documentary is, roughly 10 years old or so. So 60 years or so have passed since this. How have we not really deeply explored this? I have students read a number of things in a number of different perspectives. They read an article that talks about perhaps the more orthodox position. The Japanese started the war. We ended the war with the device. It was moral. It was justified in that context. I have them read yet another very well-written article that says this was morally not justifiable at that time. But then perhaps the most profound article that they read is one that says, by today's standards, we view this as morally unacceptable. But when you look at the context of 1945 and a total war that has killed more than 50 million individuals, that this was, in the minds of some, necessary and justifiable. And that opens the door to have a conversation about what they think, looking back.
You're hearing, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to add, there's also a very good book along these lines called The Culture of War by John Dower. And I believe the subtitle is Hiroshima 9/11 and Iraq. And the argument he makes is that there is a direct link between the bombing of Hiroshima and the way warfare has been conducted by the United States since then.
You're hearing our panel talk about 70 years since the end of World War II and the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August 6th and 9th, 1945. Eric Wheeler is with us. He's an adjunct history professor at MCC and has taught World War II classes. Richard Dee is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Rochester, and Professor Joanne Bernardi, whose research and teaching focus on Japanese cinema and culture and has examined responses, cultural responses to the end of that war and what happened. So let's take a short break and come back with your phone calls. If you're waiting on the line, you are next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, we sit down with Jarl Mohn, NPR's president and CEO, talking about the future of public radio, the future of NPR, how to bring in more members, how to make sure the important work of NPR reaches a broader audience. Then second hour, we're talking about the debate from last week, the Republicans, sexism, reporters, and candidates. That's all Tuesday.
One antidote for the dog days of summer, movies with a chill. From Frozen.
Do you want to build a snowman?
To Titanic.
I'm so cold.
To March of the Penguins.
The temperature is now 80 degrees below zero.
I'm Melissa Block. Films to keep you cool and then some later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and Roy in Rochester is first up with our panel. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes.
Long and interesting discussion carrying things through. And it just brings me back that having grown up in the 60s, all the adults, many of the adults around me, my faculty members, people I knew, were veterans. They'd fought a hot war, then gone on to live through a Cold War, and they had very distinct and I think strong views about it. And sometimes they talked about it, and others didn't share any of that. But I found myself one day sitting with William Hamilton, the Death of God theologian. He and Altizer made the front page of Time in 1964 with God is Dead. Well, apparently he was a combat infantryman on a boat headed to Japan, and the day that this happened, it changed his life. He certainly thought differently about it. I also think that you had a question about who's to judge. Can the future generations say they were wrong or not? I think Martin Harwood at the Smithsonian in 1995, the 50th anniversary, we want to do a show about Hiroshima and the Air and Space Museum. The Air and Space Museum is run by the Air Force Association. That's a show you'll never see. It didn't happen.
Yeah.
They burned the books.
They did. I think. Don't you think, Roy? Though that I think our panel is right to say that there are contexts that in 2015 it's easy to forget that the world had lost 50 million people in a protracted war, and there was this desire to see it ended before another front was opened on the Japanese mainland there. But I also think it's incumbent on us to at least ask some of these questions, not to indict, but do you think it's okay to be asking these questions as a future generation, Roy?
Oh, I absolutely do. That's why I had a conversation with Martin Harwood, got him to sign his book about telling the story about what happened to that exhibition. You know, a distinguished astronomer, not a particular political person, walked right into the worst political buzzsaw he'd ever seen. All 50 years afterwards, just trying to put together a display with the Enola Gay until about the end of the war.
Yeah. Roy, thank you for joining the conversation, and he's right. In 1995, there were all kinds of problems with trying to recognize various ceremonies, etc. It was very emotional. And Richard Dees, do we fall into traps when we try to look back on any previous generation, particularly when you really start to go back a long ways, and whether it's civil rights or it's the way people were treated in fiefdoms centuries ago, and we say, how could anybody tolerate that? We have a modern lens on these things.
Yeah, we do. I mean, I want to say one thing about that exhibit. I mean, what's sort of sad about that is that there was such a way of looking at the Hiroshima bombings in the United States that some people are offended that we could even ask the question. Mm-hmm. And I think even however you come out on it, I think you have to be able to ask this question. We have to be able to think about whether this is right or not. And we're always we'll always have a bit of a danger when we're looking at it from 70 years later or 100 years later, several hundred years later. But I don't think that absolves us from being able to make moral judgments about whether we would do the same things in the same situation, which I think is an important conversation to have, and to think about whether or not they made the right decision or not. We have to be able to judge whether they made the right decision or not. We have to do that in some context, right? We can't say, oh, well, we know everything now, and they were clearly wrong because of something they couldn't understand at the time. So you always have to make those judgments in context, but that doesn't mean you can't make the judgment.
Right. And Professor Bernardi, I think about, before the hour began, we talked about the fact that The New Yorker recently republished in full its 1946 long piece examining what happened when that first bomb hit Hiroshima through the eyes of six people who survived. A wrenching piece of journalism, of human storytelling, and eventually of suffering. And I read that piece this past week, and I would encourage anybody, you can find it now. They've republished it online. But then I think about the fact that, you know, Alan wrote the program earlier this hour and said, please keep in mind that these people were evil.
Mm-hmm.
Don't lose sight of that. These people were evil, that we had to end this. And again, we're talking about the death of more than 100,000 civilians, not the emperor, not the leadership of Japan. And do we conflate, and do we simply have to make a judgment about the cost of war? You know, I Alan's comment about these people were evil, compared to reading that New Yorker piece, there's a dissonance to me.
Right. I think it is important to keep it as personal as possible. And comments like these people were evil does conflate the Japanese into an abstract of a military evil. One of the things that prompted me to teach the course on Godzilla was when I was doing some research on the difference between the original Japanese film. I think a lot of people aren't aware that there are actually two versions of the original Godzilla film. There's the Japanese original version that opened in March of 1954, and that's called Godzilla. And then there's a Japanese version called Godzilla, King of the Monsters, that opened in 1956 with Raymond Burr, which is actually a completely re-edited version of the original film. And those two films reflect very well the different attitudes toward atomic weapons of the American people and the Japanese people, even in the 1950s. And you can tell that for the Americans, it is very much still a very abstract thing, whereas for the Japanese, it was and always has been a very personalized experience. But one of the things that really struck me when I was doing that research was I looked up to see whether or not there was a kind of tourist site or some kind of commemoralization of the Trinity site for people to go see, for example, this piece of American history. And there was, in fact, a museum. And in the museum store, which was available online, they were selling things like shot glasses, keychains, various things with the atomic bomb, the mushroom cloud, on it. And that really affected me, you know, I think, you know, and this was in 2005. Those articles were still being shown. Since that time, that museum no longer exists. There's now a much more official, much more, I think, probably scientific institution that is a museum on that site. But that kind of look, I mean, they were even sold these little what were they called? Agility games, where you would try and get the balls, you'd tilt it, and you try and get these little balls into the holes. And they would have a map of Japan, and then two holes, one over Hiroshima, one over Nagasaki. And you would roll the balls till you could get and it showed a picture of a bomb headed toward Japan. I'm not exactly sure when these were shown, but, you know, these were made in the United States of America. So, you know, I think it's important, as Professor D said, I mean, we really need to recognize what were the cultural attitudes at the time, why they were, and, you know, whether or not those cultural attitudes still persist, and what we can do to change those cultural attitudes now.
Let me get back to the phones, because we have lit them up now, and so let's get Tom in Rochester next up. Go ahead, Tom.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can. Go ahead, sir.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to agree with Richard Dess about the fact that we have become, well, maybe he didn't say this, but a nation that has turned our warfare into something different than what it was before World War II. Before that, the sense was that civilians were not targets, and you know, you've already reviewed that in the show, but the problem has been that since Dresden and Tokyo and Hiroshima and Nagasaki, every place that we have found ourselves in conflict. We have used civilians to the extent that we never did before, or that another military force maybe tried to avoid if they were trying to fight a war in what would be considered ethically, you know. And it has become part of our culture, because just that someone in the audience would say that, you know, these people were evil, or in the case that a conversation that I had with a World War II veteran, you know, it's like the enemy or those that you're fighting with become something else. Their babies, their mothers, their, you know, all of that. It's all okay to hit that, but you know, it's different when it's ours. And I'm not saying that our soldiers were wrong or that they were in a bad war or something like that. I'm just saying that the deciders, those people in our government or in governments who make the decisions that all of a sudden it's okay to hit civilian targets, they're putting us into a place where we become the terrorists. We are the terrorists. Our armies are not the terrorists, but our deciders are the terrorists.
Hey, Tom, if you don't mind, I'd like to read a comment I just received from another listener and get your take as well, given what you just told us, if that's all right with you. This is from Joel, and Joel sends an email to us that says, "In these days when 99% of Americans do not pay the price of war, it is understandable that some take moralistic positions on the use of the bomb. In 1945, hundreds of thousands were receiving telegrams reporting the death or injury of their loved ones. Many thousands of American lives were saved by avoiding an invasion, also many Japanese lives." What do you make of that?
Well, yeah, I can understand that point of view, but not... those are soldiers that he's talking about. Soldiers' lives were lost. They went into battle to fight the Great War to, you know, to keep us safe and to, you know, free Europe from the tyranny of Hitler and so forth. But when all of a sudden our targets become civilians because we want to show them what we can do, you know, the terror that we can cause them if they don't stop right now. But it was also kind of interesting that, you know, your guest pointed out that there was some experimental element to this whole thing, too. It wasn't just about ending the war. It was kind of like showing the Russians, well, this is what we can do, and we know that this bomb is better than that bomb, and, you know, look at how many people it killed and how many buildings it destroyed. But, you know, it's a different thing. You know, when you're talking about soldier death, people who go into war, you know, for a mission, and then civilian death. That's my issue.
Tom, thanks for the phone call. Richard Deese, back to that question on civilian casualties. This certainly viewed civilian casualties in a different lens. But again, that argument that Joel just emailed comes up, which says, yes, but we're talking about 50 million dead during World War II, not all soldiers, of course, and we were going to be talking about thousands more dead Japanese civilians if an invasion happened. So you can't separate that. That's what Joel and others are arguing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I want to say this again, because I think that what you really get is you get an argument of we saved a lot of American lives. I mean, I think
Joel is saying he thinks we saved Japanese lives,
yeah, no,
too.
And
there's
an
argument about
no,
that.
No, but I think the sort of gut reaction that a lot of Americans have is really we saved lots of American lives. And I think that's the thing that tilts it. That's all we should be caring about is saving American lives. Whether we save Japanese lives or not is actually an interesting question, and it depends on how the invasion was going to go, what kind of invasion was really going to be necessary. So there's a question there about what the facts are, whether the Japanese were really going to be able to, were going to surrender soon or not. Some of your listeners think that, no, they weren't going to surrender. It was really going to require a massive invasion. And if that's true, that's the best case for using the bomb. If it's true that we were going to have to invade them, that they were going to fight the way they fought in Okinawa, then we probably, if that's the case, and that's a big if, I think, then you can make the case that we saved not only American lives, but Japanese lives as well. That's an enormous if.
All right. Well, let me get to another call. This is Katie in Naples. Go ahead, Katie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have what is maybe a somewhat unique perspective on this because, first of all, my grandfather, who was from Rochester, was a B-29 pilot and flew bombing missions over Japan, though not the missions that we're talking about. And my mother-in-law is actually Japanese, and she's 82, so she grew up during the war. And she actually ended up marrying an American serviceman, you know, years later. So clearly she didn't hold any, you know, resentment towards the Americans long-term, and has told us a lot of stories about, you know, what it was like growing up during the war. And ironically, her older brother was being trained to be a kamikaze. And his number was about to come up. I mean, they had literally taken him off for his last hurrah party time with, you know, Kobe Beef and Geisha Girls. And he was then... his mission was canceled because they surrendered. So it saved his life, strangely enough. And things got rapidly better for her. But at the same time, she did see, you know, there were people walking around coming into the area where she lived that had clearly been displaced or had been affected by the bombing. And it was a painful time in their history. But if my husband and I are any indication, I guess what I'm trying to say is that time can heal all wounds. Because I don't think my grandfather at 23 flying those bombing missions would have ever thought that there's a little girl on the ground down there who's going to someday have a kid and they're going to marry my granddaughter.
Right, right. Katie, thank you for the call. It is an interesting perspective. Professor Bernardi, what do you make of that?
I think that's a very interesting story. I think we need to keep in mind, too, when we talk about the idea of saving Japanese lives, that already Japanese lives had become an abstract number with the firebombings, the incendiary firebombings of the cities in Japan. I think there were a total of about 60 cities that had been firebombed. So already the targeting of civilians, or at least the bombing of civilians, was already happening. So I find the argument that the atomic bombs saved Japanese lives, it's difficult. That's a really difficult point.
Well, let me get Mike in Rochester, who wants to weigh in on the question on civilians. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, that was a very good point that was just delivered. My father was involved, and I won't get into how, but he was involved. And, you know, the thing was that the real blame on this, there were a lot of, I mean, there were tons of bombs dropped on Japan prior to the dropping of the atomic bomb, plural. You know, Hirohito has a lot to take blame for there. You know, he's a person that pretty much had the unified country of Japan fighting his war, and imperialism was his target to keep going. And he didn't stop. He just kept going because he had subjected so many people to take their own lives in the event that precluded the bomb that he had... he should take a lot of heat for what went down. And, you know, the atomic bomb, in my opinion, as terrible as it ended up still being, was a necessary evil.
Can I just
go ahead, Richard. Thank you, Mike.
I mean, the question there is, if the leadership of Japan is evil, if we accept that, does that mean that we're allowed then to fight using evil means as well? I mean, that's the question that comes, because if you think that there's a just way to conduct a war, then the fact that other people aren't doing it is not a reason for you not to do it.
Well, but unless Mike and here's Joel again emailing back, who might say, if you go by their rules, then you will lose the war. And here's Joel saying, Hitler bombed civilians in London. The Japanese sent balloons to our west coast to kill civilians. Fortunately, those were ineffective. They were not targeting military installations. War is hell. That's Joel. And, you know, so maybe the argument is if you play by their rules, you lose. Professor Wheeler, some final thoughts from you?
I guess I would say through the lens of talking to students, you know, why is this important today? This happened 70 years ago, and yet we're still talking about this. You look at the current negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. Right. Once this war ends and we drop these two devices in August of 45, within a very short period of time by 1949, the Soviets have.
I think we've lost Professor Wheeler at the very last moment there. Professor Wheeler was on his way to making, I think, a very important point, which is that we can view this as an old story. It's a story that stays with us, the question over who gets a bomb, what's the proper conduct. So, Professor Bernardi, some final thoughts from you?
I just always look forward to teaching this course. I think it's really important to make sure that young people remember what the facts were so that they don't have these abstract ideas of, well, those people were evil, we had to bomb the hell out of them.
And Richard?
This is actually, framed in a certain way, a very difficult kind of moral question, and it's precisely the kinds of things we need to think about whenever we think about whether we're going to engage in war and what rules we're going to engage in that war in.
Yeah, I think so. And for our listeners who couldn't even get through, we're going to end the hour with the phone still ringing. And you can see, 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, people are still considering these questions and still considering the implications for us. I think we all agree on this. The world is a better place if we go forward and we never see a nuclear device hit a population center again. And let's hope. But thank you very much to our panel. Professor Wheeler was joining us earlier. I appreciate that. Richard Dees, a professor of philosophy at the University of Rochester. Thank you, sir. Thank you for being here. And Joanne Bernardi as well. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for all of the conversational points. And from our listeners today, hope you have a great afternoon. And we'll talk to you Tuesday on Connections.